A number of years ago, when the big anti-Asian hate movement or Stop Asian Hate movement was happening here in the Bay Area and all across the country, I remember I experienced something that I'd never experienced before. Growing up, I was surrounded by white people and Filipinos for whatever reason. And for some reason, I just hated my Koreanness. I don't know, maybe it was a lack of representation in media and not seeing strong Asian male archetypes. But I just didn't want to be Asian. I wanted to be white or at best Filipino, which Filipinos are amazing, by the way. They're the coolest Asians, right? And for some reason, I just hated my Asianness. And so growing up, I had that self-hatred towards myself. It wasn't until I got older that I started loving and embracing my Asianness, my Koreanness, my foreignness. And when the Stop Asian Hate movement happened a number of years ago, I remember feeling deeply impacted by what was happening all across the country. But what was the most moving part of that season for me was all of my non-Asian friends who reached out through text or through phone call and asked, how are you doing? They weren't trying to say, hey, everything's going to be all right. They weren't trying to say, hey, don't worry. They were just simply saying, I want to know how you're doing. I want to understand how you're feeling. I want to put myself in your shoes as much as I can. It was empathy. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Dr. Brené Brown, she puts empathy this way. Empathy is connecting with people so they know they're not alone. Right? Empathy is doing your best to understand, to experience and respond to another person in love. But here's the thing. People often confuse sympathy and empathy. Sympathy says, I feel for you. But empathy says, I feel with you. Right? Sympathy, if you've ever been on the receiving end of sympathy, sympathy can actually make you feel more alone. Because sympathy reserves its distance. But empathy, on the other hand, it closes the gap. It closes the distance. It helps us feel connected. Scott McKnight, he writes, empathic persons enter into the feelings of others for the sake of support, relief, and healing. With empathy, we not only recognize what others are feeling, but we try our best to feel what they're feeling. And in doing so, empathy invites us into intimacy and belonging together. Now, as you know, we're in a collection called Belong, and we're exploring five practices of belonging to help us cultivate the experience of belonging. And we've already explored the practices of chemistry and priority. And how many of y'all were here last week? Guest speaker Heidi killed it as she shared about vulnerability. And the truth is, we all come into the world, if you've ever had kids, we all come into the world in the most vulnerable position. And we find ourselves growing up in vulnerable positions. And every time our vulnerability isn't met with empathy, we start hiding out of self-preservation. And this is why empathy follows vulnerability in our journey of belonging. If you ever shared something deeply with someone, and you weren't met with the kind of response you were hoping for, with someone who was trying to seek to understand, you know how difficult it is and how from that moment forth you might be a little more guarded. But empathy's gift, its true gift, is safety. You know, every one of us, we're going to experience all types of losses in our lives. We're going to experience the loss of health, the loss of friends, the loss of family members, the loss of dreams, the loss of money, relationships, jobs, loved ones. It's unavoidable. And if pain and brokenness are an inevitable part of the human experience, much of doing life with others is learning how to do grief shared. And that's what empathy is. It's grief shared. Dr. Brené Brown, she goes on to say, empathy has no script. There is no right way or wrong way to do it. It's simply listening, holding space, withholding judgment, emotionally connecting, and communicating that incredibly healing message of you're not alone. Empathy means I see you and I hear you, and it's an invitation into togetherness. But sadly, you've probably noticed that empathy is not very common in our world today. Actually, a lot of people saying we're facing an empathy deficit. Professors, psychologists, and empathy researchers, they all observed a steep decline of empathy in our world today. We lack concern for others when they're in pain. We don't know how to listen to understand in our conversations. We spend more time arguing about how to fight injustice than actually helping those who are affected by it. There's a staggering statistic that shows that research has shown that 68% of CEOs in America say they fear they will be less respected if they show empathy. And I think that just shows how little we regard empathy in our relationships. But thankfully, empathy is a skill that we can develop. It's a muscle that we can flex. And so we're going to talk a little bit about how we can do that in the context of community in the church. But before we get into that, I want to talk about four enemies of empathy. The first is indifference. You know, before the internet, humans throughout history, they had access mainly only to local news. They didn't have any access to global news. It would take months or even years for news of anything happening far away to reach your area. You know, the other day I saw a video of a little hedgehog resuscitated to life in infancy and grown up. And it was somewhere in South America. And I remember thinking, man, I would never have access to this had it not been for globalization. And we have access to all sorts of cute, cool, exciting, inspiring things from all around the world. Globalization has given our society access to information and resources like never before. But with this new, quick, and instant access to information, we're also exposed all the more to the horrors and the atrocities of the world like never before. Right, we read of a natural disaster that took hundreds of lives. Then we see a post about a friend's cancer diagnosis. Then we watch a clip of someone being unjustly murdered by the police. Then we see photos of children being killed in Palestine. It goes on and on and on. The Oxford English Dictionary actually named doom scrolling the word of 2020. It was the word of the year, which is basically the tendency to continue scrolling through bad news. The good thing about this is that we no longer have any excuse to turn a blind eye to the pain and suffering and injustices of the world. But the danger, the bad thing, is that overexposure to all of this can actually make our hearts grow numb, apathetic, calloused. We can actually become desensitized and indifferent toward others' pain. I don't know if you've been following, hopefully you've been following the news about what's been going on in Palestine and Gaza. And I remember when the first wave of news hit the internet, I remember weeping, seeing these pictures of children under rubble and my heart being broken. And the other week, I found myself reading the same news that I did months ago, but not reacting as strongly to it. And I find that over time, if we're not careful, overexposure to bad news and the horrors and atrocities and injustices of the world, if we're not intentional, our hearts become uncalloused and we become indifferent to other people's pain. And so we have to be intentional about keeping our hearts tender and soft. The second enemy is impatience. Now, Krista and I, when we were very young in our relationship, I tell y'all all the time I'm an Enneagram type 7. What does that mean? It basically means the core fear in my life is to be trapped in cycles of pain and unable to escape. And so that means I hate having hard conversations. I hate having to deal with negative emotions. But Krista, on the other hand, is amazing at dealing with all sorts of emotions, a range and a spectrum of emotions. And I remember early on in our relationship when Krista was struggling or she was hurt or she was experiencing pain, my posture was, yo, you don't have to live like that. Get yourself out of that pain. Everything's going to be okay. Look on the bright side. And I came from a really good place, but I remember Krista would be so hurt by that. And every time she would come to me with a problem, I would try to fix it, or I would try to put rose-colored sunglasses over it to show her the better side. And I remember after time, she looked at me dead in the eye and she said, stop doing that. I want you to know that I'm not stuck in this just to be stuck in this. I'm experiencing the emotion so that I can go through it and I could come on the other side. You need to trust that that's what I'm doing. But we're impatient. When someone expresses anxiety or a need, we often get overwhelmed because we feel like it's our responsibility to fix their problems. But more often than not, people aren't looking for solutions. They're looking for someone to be there for them, to know they're not alone, to know that someone cares. But we love quick fixes because empathy is actually time consuming. Empathy takes mental and emotional energy. Empathy is rarely convenient or comfortable. Empathy takes patience because it leads us into the unknown. There's no time frame for when someone will get better. There's no linear pathway that will guarantee a positive outcome. And we hate the slow process of sitting with people in their pain. We'd rather lift them out quickly so we can get back to being happy and eating good food and enjoying life. But we don't realize that it's only when people sit through their pain that they can experience true joy. I had to learn that as an Enneagram Type 7 the hard way. And with Krista, I had to realize that she's a grown adult and that she would figure it out. She just needed someone to listen, to give her reassurances as a friend, to make sure she didn't feel alone. And so we have indifference. We have the second one, which is impatience, and the third enemy, insecurity. There's a story in the Old Testament about Saul and David. I'm just going to read it for us. 1 Samuel 18:6 through 9. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. And as they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." Saul was very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. "They have credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a close eye on David. Now get this. Saul had defeated thousands as a king and as a warrior, which is probably more than any of us would do in a lifetime, right? It's quite an accomplishment. But even despite having this amazing accomplishment under his belt as the leader of his nation, as soon as Saul's victories were compared to David's, insecurity kicked in. And had Saul not been so insecure, he and David might have actually been good friends. They might have actually experienced belonging with one another. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. You know, when I was in the music biz, I say that like I wasn't really in the music biz, but I was kind of in the music biz. I was playing a little bit. But I remember when I got, when I experienced some really cool achievements and I saw my streams, all my streams moved into 100,000, moved to 500,000. I remember I was so happy. But then I remember seeing my other friend who was in the same lane, who was also a rapper, and he got to a milli. And I remember looking at my 500,000, and I was like, dang. And I remember feeling so down after that. When we start to compare to others, we're unable to be there with them, to connect with them in empathy. Insecurity blocks us from empathy. We're not able to celebrate others' wins and blessings and victories because we're too busy comparing their lives to our own. And we need to keep others small so that we can feel big. And then the fourth enemy, ignorance. Ignorance can cause us to be insensitive and tone deaf toward others. We become out of touch, unaware, careless, and even cruel to the nuances of people's lives. It's telling your friend you got a huge raise when they just shared about losing their job. It's talking to a group of stay-at-home moms and saying how easy they have it compared to working moms. It's telling an anxious person to just get over it and be more brave. It's not checking in on your friends who may have been particularly affected by a recent tragedy in the news. It's really the inability to read the room. In Korean, we have a term for it. It's nunchi. It's not having that sense, that understanding, the EQ to meet people where they're at. I remember at my last church, I was a pastor in my mid-20s, pastoring ages from youth all the way into senior adulthood. And I remember I was pastoring married couples and young parents. And I remember going to my staff meetings, being so frustrated at these parents who had just given birth, who had 2-3-year-olds running around saying, "They're not coming to our leadership meetings. They never show up to service on time. They're not serving at our church. What are they doing?" And I remember being so frustrated. And I remember approaching some of them sometimes saying, "Hey, you got to step up. You need to show up. We need to see you here at church." But guess what? 10 years later, now that I have a young kid, I get it. But at that time, I was completely ignorant to what they were experiencing, and I cut off connection because of my ignorance. Human relationships require wisdom, nuance, and sensitivity, all which can only come by way of empathy. And I think we're especially bad at this in the church. You know, we're going to read about Job and his three friends in a bit, but think about them. When they saw Job suffering, they were convinced that Job was suffering due to his sins. They're like, God is mad at you. He's punishing you because you've been wicked. And instead of empathizing with Job's pain, their ignorance caused them to be careless and cruel towards him. And I love this. Job 42:7, eventually God steps in towards his friends and says, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Bad theology can prevent genuine care, love, and support. Have you ever experienced that? Job's friends thought their job was to correct their friend rather than simply be there for him. And how often do we do that as followers of Jesus? Instead of being there for others when they're struggling, we preach to them. Empathy doesn't necessarily mean we co-sign with what people are doing. It simply means that we want to seek understanding so that they're not alone. All right, so all of these enemies of empathy bring distance, not closeness. They keep us from experiencing belonging with one another. Now, I want to open up to Job, as we've been talking about. You know, Job's friends, as I just mentioned, they're often made out to be like bad examples of how not to do friendship and bad examples of empathy in the midst of suffering. And while they did miss their mark eventually, in many ways, they also did some things really right. And so I want to explore the first 7 days after Job starts experiencing unprecedented suffering and how his friends respond in empathy. So let's go to Job 2:11 through 13. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Nahamite. That sounds like a rap. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they didn't recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept. And they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. As much as Job's friends get bashed, in the first 7 days, look at what they do. They see that their friend is suffering. And they get together and they try to come up with a game plan about how they could care for their friend. And then they fully immerse themselves in Job's pain, not just saying, hey, I'll be there for you, but they literally cry tears of pain with Job. Physical acts like tearing their robes. I remember in college, I don't know why, but we went through a phase of tearing our shirts off. Like, we read this passage, and I remember my friend would come to me, he's like, I'm going through a tough week, and I would just... like, I'll just rip my shirt off. College kids are so dumb. But I remember doing that as a joke. But here in this society, in this time, it was an act of solidarity, saying, I feel for you. I am grieved to the point that I'm tearing this off of my body. And most importantly, they sat with Job. They sat with their friend for 7 days and seven nights in silence. Think about that. 7 days and seven nights in silence, no words of advice, no words of encouragement, just sitting with their friend in deep pain. This is actually a really beautiful picture of empathy. And despite them later messing it up later, a few days later, but here in the beginning, in the first 7 days, they embodied what empathy looks like. Jesus was also the master of showing empathy. You know, there are many times in Jesus' ministry where it says he was moved by compassion toward others. What is compassion? Compassion is empathy in action. It's putting action to our ability to be there for people. And there's this particular moment right after his friend, his good friend Lazarus died, when we see Jesus' empathy most clearly. John 11:32 to 35, when Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. Think about this for a moment. Jesus knew he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead a few verses later. He knew he was about to perform one of the greatest miracles of all time. He knew that his friend wasn't actually gone. Yet he sees the suffering and the tears and the anguish and the pain of people like Mary. And instead of telling her to cheer up or saying, hey, he's coming back, he takes time to weep with her. We see time and time again, Jesus was willing to enter into people's pain, to close the distance and feel what people were feeling. What does it say about a God who's willing to weep with us in our pain, to sit with us in our brokenness? Hebrews 4:15, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Jesus understands the human struggle, our frustrations, our struggles, our desperation, and he meets them with empathy, not indifference. But I love that he doesn't just feel sorry for us. He's able to help us. Scripture reminds us that we have the Holy Spirit, who is the Paraclete, which translates as the comforter, advocate, or helper. Now, I want to talk briefly about bungee cord Jesus. Have you ever heard about bungee cord Jesus? I'm going to tell you all about bungee cord Jesus. I used to have a drawing that I drew of bungee cord Jesus, but it was so bad and no one understood it that I took it away. But let me tell you about bungee cord Jesus. This is a helpful analogy of what Jesus' empathy can look like in our lives. Now, imagine that you're on the edge of a cliff. And for whatever reason, you know, you get distracted and you see a beautiful butterfly and you slip off the cliff and you're plummeting to your doom. Okay, pretend the cliff is really high, like those cartoons, and it's taken a while for you to hit the ground. And imagine that you fall off the cliff, but your friend runs up to the edge of the cliff, stops, looks down on you as you're falling, and they start yelling at you, hey, everything's gonna be okay. Don't worry. Don't be sad. God is in control. And you're hearing the voice get further and further away from you because even though he's saying all these incredible things, you're falling to your death. And you keep falling and falling until you could hear his voice no longer, and then you hit the ground and you die. Now, sometimes that's how we respond to others when they're going through something. We talk at people from the top of our cliffs in our comfort, in our safety. And instead of being with them in their suffering, we're yelling at them, saying it's going to be okay, even though they're falling to their demise. Now imagine a second scenario. You fall off the same cliff. This time you saw a beautiful eagle and you got distracted and you slipped off and you're falling and falling. But this time your friend sees you falling and he runs and he jumps off the cliff after you. And somehow, you know, maybe physics aren't coming into play and he catches up to you. And as you're plummeting, you're both falling together and he embraces you. And you guys are falling to your death. And they're whispering in your ear saying, hey, I'm here. I'm with you. Everything's going to be okay. And for a brief moment, you feel the comfort of not being alone. You feel his embrace. But then you realize, shoot, we're both falling to our death. And then you both hit the ground together and you die. Now, sometimes in our attempts to help others, we actually get caught up in their pain and end up stuck in what they're going through. Have you ever experienced that? You're trying to be there for your friend, and you actually end up also depressed or also experiencing what they're experiencing so much to the point that now you can't get yourself out, and we forget where they end and where we begin. But here is a third scenario. You fall off the cliff for whatever reason, but in comes bungee cord Jesus, okay? And Jesus, he runs. He sees you falling and he jumps after you. And he catches up to you. And as you're falling and spiraling, he holds you as you're falling to your demise. You feel his embrace. You feel his closeness. He says, I am with you. He's right there in the thick of it, in the falling, in the spiraling with you. And right before you hit the ground, you bounce back up together. This is what empathy looks like. We sit with others in their pain so that we can eventually come out of it together. This is why the psalmist said, weeping may stay for the night, but rejoicing comes in the morning. This is empathy. being with others while attached to the bungee cord of God's Spirit. We can be with others in their pain and stay rooted to the hope of Jesus without being preachy, knowing that he will pull them out in his time. And so the good news is, as you're hearing all this, even if you're not naturally an empathetic person, it's actually a skill that we can work on and develop. And so I want to focus on a few skills that will help us practice growing in empathy. And the idea here isn't to master all of them right now. It's simply to choose one that you feel like God is challenging you to grow in and work on one at a time. And when you're ready, you can move on to another practice. So the first one is this: ask the scariest question. What is the scariest question? You might be thinking, maybe it, how's my breath? Maybe it's, will you go out with me? What is the scariest question? Growth is impossible without awareness. And one of the clearest signs of maturity is self-awareness, is when you know how you are, who you are, your tendencies, your weaknesses, as well as your strengths. If you want to grow in awareness, I think the best and possibly the scariest question that you could ask others is this: how do you experience me? And just be honest, how do you experience me when you're around me and I'm talking to you and we're together? What do you experience when you're around me? And I think no matter where you are, this question reveals so much about who you are, how empathetic you are, how well you listen, how well you embody presence. I remember when I was a pastor at the last church I was at, I would periodically ask my volunteers, how do you experience me? How am I as a leader? And I remember thinking I had thick skin, but as soon as someone gave me even the nicest bit of critique, I remember crumbling. And they're like, hey, Mickey, you're so nice. You're so nice. But you're like a little too nice. We need a little more structure. We need a little more discipline. We need you to be firm with us. And I remember taking that, and that's like the nicest thing you could say to someone, the nicest way you could say it to them. But I remember going home and crumbling under the weight of their words. It's a scary question to put yourself out there like that. How do you experience me? It will show you where you need more work and growth. But another approach may be asking, maybe if you're not ready for that question, maybe going up to someone and asking them to give you feedback on your listening skills. Hey, on a scale of 1 through 10, how would you rate my listening skills? Listen, some of y'all think you're good listeners. You're not. And you'll find out if you ask this question: how are my listening skills? Can you rate me on a scale of 1 through 10? How can I be a better listener? So ask the scariest questions. Another way is to celebrate others. Romans 12, 15 through 16, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward another. How many of you know that empathy is not only reserved for situations that are incredibly sad? There's also something that psychologists call positive empathy, right? We tend to associate empathy primarily with people suffering and pain, but celebrating for those who are celebrating is also a crucial part of empathy and belonging. In other words, empathy includes both the highs and the lows of life. Think back to your birthdays, key accomplishments, milestones, where people are genuinely happy for you and with you. How does that make you feel? You know, it's no coincidence that when you get excited about something, you find a restaurant that you really like, or you listen to a song that you think is really dope, or you watch a movie that moves you, one of your first instincts is to what? To share it with someone you love. But have you ever experienced when you share that with someone and they're like, they watch the movie that you love, they're like, it was all right. Or they try the food that you recommended, they're like, I've had better, right? But our natural tendency is to share our joy with others. And one of the best ways to grow out of a self-absorbed lifestyle is to celebrate others, not just yourself. To share in other people's joy, and in doing so, their joy becomes our joy. I had a friend in our group who every time he got a job promotion would take us out to eat all-you-can-eat Brazilian barbecue here in San Francisco. And there was like 12 of us. So I felt really bad for him at one point, but I was like, he's making a lot of money. I think he'll be okay. And I remember every time we go out, you know, I think Epestis or whatever it is in San Francisco, all-you-can-eat Brazilian barbecue, amazing. But they sell these little Coke bottles for $3.50, which are like less than a can. But I remember I was drinking one and I finished it like 1 minute into my meal. And I looked at my friends like, should we get another one? We shouldn't. We had five each that night. But there was just something about sharing in the joy and celebrating with our friend. It wasn't just his joy anymore. We got to celebrate too with five bottles of overpriced Coke. Celebration both strengthens and reinforces belonging. In the Old Testament, God frequently called for festivals and celebrations to remind Israel that they belong to him and to one another. But here's the thing, we're great at celebrating big moments in life, like weddings and graduations and birthdays and anniversaries, but we're not as great celebrating the small moments that matter. You know, these small moments celebrated consistently over time produce greater empathy and belonging than many of the bigger moments in life. Whether it's going out for drinks to celebrate the end of a difficult work week, or words of affirmation celebrating a consistent month of exercise, or ordering in dessert to celebrate successfully sleep training your kid. I remember when we first sleep trained Zion, Krista and I celebrated quietly in our living room because we were so happy. It's the small moments celebrated consistently over time that build this deep connection of empathy with one another. Celebrating others helps us grow in empathy. Just a few more and then we'll wrap up. Practice validation. You know, communication is so much more than words. It actually may be more nonverbal than verbal. So facial expressions, tone of voice, body posture, gestures, physical distance, they all matter. And Dallas Willard was the one who said that the first act of love is always the giving of intention. You know, we can show others we're paying attention by making eye contact, by asking questions, by not interrupting. You know, often when we share, we're looking for someone to validate what we're experiencing, someone to pay attention and truly see what we're going through. And when we're not met with validation, we actually are more reluctant to share again, and we end up putting up barriers to protect ourselves. Now, here's some examples of invalidating responses, so you're not doing it right. You'll be fine. It could be worse. Just suck it up. And my personal least favorite, just let go and let God. Sometimes it works, but many times it doesn't. Some examples of validating responses, phrases you could use instead. Oh, wow, that sounds really hard. That would also drive me crazy. You put a lot of work into that. I could see why you're so frustrated. Right, practicing validation helps us grow in empathy. Now, just two more. Fill in the blanks. When someone's going through a difficult time, and I do this all the time, people often respond by saying something like, yo, let me know if you need anything. Sounds great, right? And it actually is a really kind thing to say, and it comes from a genuine place of care and concern, but I realize that oftentimes this puts more responsibility on the recipient by requiring them to both think of their needs and to reach out again. And more times than not, when we're going through something tough, we don't even know what we need. And so when someone asks us, hey, how can I be here for you? It's hard, like going through that and trying to articulate what you're going through and what you need. It's often more helpful to offer a few suggestions and allow others to pick one. For example, I remember when I was sick a few months ago, I got someone randomly DoorDashed me food. Someone randomly dropped off groceries and stuff. They just randomly cared for me in these ways. They didn't ask me, hey, do you need anything? They just did it. And so maybe we can offer, hey, let me drop off some food. Let me buy you a cup of coffee. Let me take your kids to the park so you can get a small break. I really feel that one. Let me gather some friends so that we could spend some time together. This shows that you've actually spent time thinking through what might be helpful for them, and you're giving them the agency and freedom to choose what would help them most. All right, two more. Adjust your frequency. Sometimes in our attempt to love others, we like totally miss the mark. Not because our hearts are in the wrong place, but because the way we give love and receive love may be different because we're on different frequencies. Have you heard of Gary Chapman's book, The Five Love Languages? It's super helpful in relationships and in friendships, and it's really practical in this area. So he basically theorizes that the five love languages are touch, physical touch, words of affirmation, quality time, gifts, and acts of service. And the main point of this book is that all of us give and receive love very differently. For example, let me just give you a glimpse into my relationship with my wife. I'm a I'm a high, very high physical touch and words of affirmation. Pretty much I'm like a puppy dog, right? My dog, all he needs is like a pet and tell him, you're a good boy, and he's happy. I'm literally the exactly same way. Like, even if we don't go on dates, if Krista just comes up to me after a long day where we're apart, and she just like rubs my back and says, hey, I love you. You're doing a great job. Gives me a kiss. Like, I'm set for life. Like, she could do that once a week and I'm good, right? But Krista, I discovered, is highest with quality time, which ironically is like my lowest love language. And so, like, when I thought quality time, I thought, oh, you know, like, if we're sitting to get next to each other on the couch and we're each on our phones, because I also love doing that, that's not quality time, right? When we're just watching a movie together mindlessly, that's not quality time. It's being completely attentive to one another, asking each other how we're doing. That's quality time for her. And I realized in the beginning of our relationship, when I would try to love her the way that I receive love, so I'd like touch her, I'd hold her hand, I'd say, oh my God, you're the most amazing, you're doing great at work today, you're killing it, girl. Like, when I say all these things to her, it's like good, but it's not hitting. And so even after a day of loving her and touching her and saying nice things to her, she would still not feel loved until we actually spent quality time together. And so in my attempts to love her, I could shower her with the most eloquent words all day, give her hundreds of hugs and kisses, which sounds amazing to me, but she may still feel unloved unless we spend quality, intentional time together. And this is why it's helpful to lean into how people are wired to receive love. Humans, we're so complex, and we have a greater understanding. When we have a greater understanding of how we're wired and how others are wired, our ability to lean into them is so much stronger. And so using tools like the 5 love languages, Enneagram, Myers-Briggs, or various other assessments can actually help us grow in empathy. And last one, self-differentiate. We have to be careful not to move so far into someone else's feelings that we end up confusing what's what and whose is whose. They call it enmeshment, and it's a counterfeit version of empathy where we end up taking on the other person's pain and end up making it about ourselves. Have you ever experienced that? Where the focus goes now on my pain and my emotional distress about what you're going through that the attention shifts away from you and back onto me. Or we get so wrapped up in empathic engagement that we experience the other person's stress and pain for days and weeks to come, carrying a burden we were never meant to carry. And if we're not careful, they actually say that first responders and therapists can experience what's known as vicarious trauma. That even though it's not something they directly experience, but by trying to enmesh themselves with someone else's pain, it becomes their own and it's a form of trauma. The ability to offer proper empathy requires differentiation. Let me define that for you really quick by Steve Cuss. Differentiation is attaining clarity on where you end and the other begins. The two opposites are indifference and enmeshment, healthy space, clarity of values, while staying connected to one another. Differentiated people can manage their reactivity and become a non-anxious presence. In other words, too much individuality leads us to become indifferent and disconnected. But too much togetherness leads us to become enmeshed and entangled with someone else's emotions. Differentiation is only possible when we've learned how to set healthy boundaries in our efforts to love and care for others. And hear me, church, protecting our boundaries isn't selfish. It isn't anti-gospel. It's actually necessary in order to love the way that God has called us to love. This is why Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. If we're not able to protect the boundaries that we need to love ourselves well, we cannot love others well. And so this requires us to take time to ask ourselves, how am I doing? Is this their stuff or is it my stuff? Galatians 6:2-5 says, carry each other's burdens. That word there is baros. For each one should carry their own load. That word there is phorcion. Notice that the two different Greek words that are used here, baros in Greek means a heavy burden and weight that requires assistance. It's something that I can't carry on my own. But the second word, phorcion, is more of a traveler's pack, a load that an individual can carry on their own. So self-differentiation invites us to discern what we're called to be responsible for and what we're called to share and carry together with others. And so I just want to throw out all these skills to you. Working on one skill at a time is probably most effective. And when you're ready, you can move on to another skill or practice. And so I want to invite us now. I know that's a lot of information, but I want to invite us now into a time of response. So why don't we close our eyes and why don't we ask Holy Spirit to come? I don't know where you are on your journey of empathy. Maybe you're a great empathic person. Or maybe you're like me, where your heart's in the right place, but you don't really know how to empathize. But I can tell you, as a case study, I can tell you that being around Krista, being married to her, who's a naturally gifted empathic person, 8 years now, we just celebrated 8 years this last week, I can tell you that I've become a more empathic person. And so this is a skill that we can grow in. So I want you to ask God, God, first of all, how good am I with empathizing with others? Do I ever come against any of these enemies of empathy? Do I experience indifference to people's pain? Do I experience impatience? And I'm like, I just need to lift you out. Why are we wasting time? Do I experience any of these things? Do I experience any of these enemies that keep me far and removed from other people's belonging? And another question is, which of these skills is God inviting you to practice in this season? Is there any area that God is calling you to grow? Any way that he's challenging you to grow in empathy in community? I want you to think about this community. How can you practice empathy in this season here at 99? Whether it's with your community group or people you're serving with or people that you know or people that you see on Sunday. Is there anyone in our community that needs your empathy? Is there anyone that God is calling you to be with in the pit? Is there anyone that God is calling you to celebrate with at this moment? Right now, just ask God, what is something that you're moving my heart to do right now? God, I thank you that you see us, you hear us, you know us, you understand us. And it's your empathy, it's your kindness that draws us near to your heart. I pray that we would learn to embody that all the more in our relationships. So teach us what it means to live as you lived, to love as you loved, to be there for one another the way that you have been there for us. A God who sees, knows, and understands us. A God who is truly with us. We love you, we honor you, and we thank you for this time and space. In Jesus' name we pray, we say, Amen.